From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We want to be done with big unemployment and bad times. We thought maybe we were. And then came what economists call the black swan of Europe's maybe crack-up and slowdown in China and slowdown in India and slowdown in U.S. jobs numbers. And suddenly, everybody's looking for shelter again. This hour, On Point, fear of stallout in the world economy. And what comes next? You can join the conversation. Are we stuck? Are we sliding backwards at the mercy of global events that whack us every time a recovery tries to get started? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Stocks plunged on Friday after news of May's week's jobs report hit. Here was Maria Bartiromo of CNBC as the markets closed on Friday.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average tonight down 275 points. Now the Dow is negative for 2012, wiping out all of the gains that we saw earlier in the year. S&P 500 gave up 32 points, and the Nasdaq took a real hit, down about 79 points. Technology, financial services, energy, materials, economically sensitive names, all down the tubes today.
All down the tubes, just where we don't want to be. We have two smart economists with us today to look out on the world. Joining me in the studio now, Ken Rogoff, professor of public policy and economics at Harvard University, the co-author of This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. Ken Rogoff, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Also with us, Alan Sinai, chief global economist, strategist, and president at Decision Economics. Alan Sinai, great to have you back as well.
Nice to see you, Tom.
Ken, what is going on?
Well, I think there's no doubt the storm clouds are over Europe right now. And with a chaotic election in Greece, with the change of president in France, they've reached a crescendo where there's a real possibility of a core meltdown in Europe in the coming months. The far better chance is that they make a quantum leap towards political unification and somehow, you know, keep things going. But if you're going into surgery being told there's a 20% chance you're going to die, that's not very encouraging.
Alan, are the markets, I mean, that's only one indicator of what's going on. Are they gauging the risks here appropriately? Are they underestimating the risk? I mean, how slippery a cliff are we on right now?
We have a stock market correction that's down 10, maybe it could get as bad as down 20% from previous peaks. And it is on a number of things. Number one, it's Europe, the Eurozone, and the potential effects over the next 3 to 6 months of a full-fledged, much worse recession in the Eurozone and Europe that is and would spread through Asia and then come back to hit us. We'll be the last man standing. Our numbers are actually pretty good. But it's that anticipation and selling off in anticipation that gives us the correction. That's the risk, not necessarily will be the reality. But the reality of global slowdown and core meltdown in Europe, that's the issue. Can Germany stay when 45% of the Eurozone is in deep recession and it's getting worse? It's a lack of proper policy actions and really a complicated negative feedback set of loops that makes this really black swan and very worrisome.
Black swan meaning that unexpected kind of rare event. People don't think about it, and here suddenly it comes. The Europe that everybody thought was just a fact may be unraveling.
You know, it's been festering for over 3 years. You know, the knit of Greece and when the markets attacked their paper, the bailout of Greece and the political override of the European leaders to keep it all together. That's a fundamental error. And they keep on trying to do that. And it has gotten worse and worse and worse. But black swan to me means we've never seen anything like this before. This is a moment of history for Europe. And that's what makes it so difficult for doctors like us. For us not to be nervous about the ramifications of this.
Ken, talk to us about the risks. Now, you know, you say it depends on a quantum leap toward deeper unification in Europe. And, of course, that could happen. And I guess the way you describe it, we have to hope that it does. But if they don't pull it off, how do the dominoes work here, if that's the right metaphor? What's the risk scenario?
Well, let me start out at the point that you began the program saying there are a lot of other weaknesses. We are not strong right now. China's contracting and in a political disarray. We don't know what's going on there. U.S. has had a slowdown. Even India's had a slowdown. So the economy is not robust and strong and able to take a big meltdown in Europe right now. But basically, the risk is that essentially there's an ongoing panic in Europe. I think, as Alan said, Greece eventually is going to have to go. I don't know if it's going to go now and temporarily exit the Eurozone. But where will it stop? Who's next? Clouds are gathering over Spain. The Spanish say, hey, no problem. We're fine. Just give us a little. They're crazy. They're in complete denial. There's a lot of problems. And if Spain were to go, Spain's huge compared to Greece. Mm-hmm. And the banks in France and Germany would be hit. At the end of the day, there's a possibility even France could get forced to exit the euro. And this would be as bad or worse than Lehman. It's very hard. What happened in 2008?
I mean, there was a time when these things would have seemed far away. France, Spain, Greece, so what? But you're saying the blowback would come globally. It would hit here. How does that work? How do the pieces fall if they fall badly?
Well, they hit us in a couple ways. But first and foremost, it's through financial markets. You would just see a collapse of global stock markets in the face of this because they're looking down the road. Again, as Alan said, it'll spread first to Asia. We have a lot of exports there, but also we have exports to Europe. We're a relatively closed economy, but not that closed. Mm-hmm. We depend on the world. A lot of our profits in recent years have been coming from abroad. So weakness in Europe and Asia, it also spread to Latin America. We will not be immune. If Europe really had this worst-case scenario, we would not just be having a mild recession. We would have a deep recession here.
Alan, paint it. How does it work?
Well, here are some of the numbers. Right now, 45% of the Eurozone is in recession or depression, and it is getting worse on the flow of data. Germany is a very open economy with a lot of trade in Europe. 40% of German GDP is exports. So it's exposed to 45%. And the latest is Spain deepening and worsening with a banking problem, having to consolidate the banks so they're not lending. And so that economy is going to get worse, and Italy is getting worse. So German exports on the latest data that we just got, German numbers are softening. Germany has looked good to date, but if Germany weakens, it will take France down with it. And then you've got 95% of the Eurozone, 85% of Europe in recession, prolonged deep. That then hits China, second largest economy in the world. China's exports weaken. Economies, they weaken. Then all of that hits U.S., 14% of GDP in exports. That's our hope. It's not as big as consumption, which is 70% of GDP. If the consumer
stays
up. You mean
you hope that it just hits the export part of the American economy.
And that the consumer that is doing relatively well keeps on spending. But here's the problem. The stock market weakens on this, and then you get feedback effects from a bad stock market, maybe on consumption. And that's the process by which it all goes. And that's what the markets are anticipating as a risk.
Can we not bear up in the face of Europe's trouble, China's trouble, if we've got 70, 75% of our economy consumer-driven inside the United States, Ken?
No, not if it gets bad enough. I mean, let's just remember the best chance is Europe figures this out, that we see the historic quantum leap towards essentially having Germany write a blank check across Europe that bails them out and gets them through to the next stage as they go to political union. But no, if that doesn't happen, this would be as bad as 2008 because it would hit our banks, it would hit our lending, it would hit our exports, it would hit confidence. It's really hard to know. It's hard to evaluate exactly. It's not a typical thing. But this wouldn't just be a recession. This would be darker than that. But again, that's if Europe doesn't figure a way out.
Alan, people are still at this point saying 2-3% growth for the United States this year, looking forward toward the end of the year. I think you yourself. Is that all hinging on some, miracle?
No, that's a basic prospect. It's based on better fundamentals for the consumer, 70%, a little better housing, and this thing blowing over in some form of fashion. They muddle through. There's another case.
So 2-3% growth, which is far from recession,
it's okay. It's based on muddle through. But it's that growth for the second half that we're most concerned about now. I call it the basic prospect. The basic prospect is really at risk here.
And if it goes the wrong way, what could we be looking at, Ken? We're back into flat growth. We're back into recession. Worse than that, what about employment consequences?
I think unemployment would get worse. I mean, again, this is a really dark possible scenario between what's going on in Europe, what's going on in China. It is not the most likely, but it's become more than just an outside risk. But no, we're talking about minus 5% growth. We're talking about unemployment going way up at the very least. And it would be worse in Europe, much worse.
Alan, do you see Europe getting its act together in the face of this kind of threat to itself?
So far they haven't. I think what they've done policy-wise has made it much worse. Austerity now, which was a solution to the deficits and debt for them, they thought, is a complete failure. They've admitted that. They now tell us they want to do pro-growth austerity. I don't see any content in pro-growth. It's just a bunch of words. And now they are meeting, they're going to meet. And G7 is talking about this. They've been late, too little, too late, behind the curve. The dynamics of these downturns get so far beyond the policymakers that when they do act, especially in Europe with 17 countries deciding, they make it worse. You know, we hope that this will kind of burn out and pick up on its own. But it really doesn't look like that.
But Germany, Ken saying, they may have in the end to write the check. Do you see the willingness there to?
Well, that's a big political game now. I think what you're seeing from Ms. Merkel is some showing of the cards of a German model for Europe, and that's what she's negotiating in terms of giving some of what Germany has to give. And so now in the whole mix, we have the politics of what Germany wants to accomplish for Europe, and that makes it even more complicated. Mm. It's not just numbers anymore. It's mixed up with politicians.
What a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the fear of a stall out in the world economy and the road ahead scenarios. Ken Rogoff is with us. He's professor at Harvard University, author of This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. Sounds like we've got a little folly going on right now. Alan Sinai joins us as well, chief global economist, strategist, president at Decision Economics. President Obama bringing European economics into his weekly radio address. Here was in Golden Valley, Minnesota on Friday, saying the U.S. economy is facing some strong headwinds, some from across the Atlantic.
We had high gas prices a month, 2 months ago, and they're starting to come down, and they were spiking, but they're still hitting people's wallets pretty hard. That has an impact. And then, most prominently, most recently, we've had a crisis in Europe's economy that is having an impact worldwide, and it's starting to cast a shadow on our own as well. So we've got a lot of work to do before we get to where we need to be.
Hang on to your hats, folks. Even the president looking across the pond. All right, we've got some scary scenario on the table. Let's just pause for a minute here. We get it. It's out there. It's looming, and it may happen, and it would be bad if it does. But give us the upside option here. I mean, there's always an upside option. Ken, what's the dodge the bullet brighter scenario here?
Well, it comes back to Germany needing to write a blank check to back the weak countries in Europe to stop the banking crises, forgiving some of the debts that just are never going to get paid, and in return, getting a deal where there's a move towards political union, which Germany wants, not necessarily German-ruled political union. And the French, of course, are resisting this. If I might, Tom, I think an analogy that might explain what's going on is think of the euro as a young couple that thinks they want to get married, but they're not sure, so they decide to open a joint checking account. And it works well, and they bring in their brother and sister and then some cousins. Mm-hmm. And after a while, it gets out of control because there's no legal framework, to govern who pays what. That's really what's going on.
We thought they were married. They've been
well,
living in sin.
Exactly. And they need to get married or at least announce an engagement.
We'll look at how that might work. But, Alan, if we dodge the bullet here, I mean, you talked about some strengths in the U.S. economy. If it doesn't go down the chute, is there a brighter scenario for the year ahead?
What's the upside? Of course. By the way, there is another scenario, which is I don't really think they're going to get a political union. It's more likely to break apart. That's terrible. The divorce is terrible. But afterwards, it could be better. But let me go back to your question.
Afterwards can take a long time and a lot of
so can, detritus. So can trying to get political union.
Good for the lawyers in either event.
Yeah. That hasn't worked
quick,
yet.
Give us the upside scenario. We need to hear it.
That, I think internally, in our system and in business cycles, we are really in orbit. It's sustained and sustainable in terms of what's going on here.
You mean we're up out of the recession?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a kind of a low path, mm-hmm. you know, of 2-2.5% mm-hmm. On average growth, fed by the consumer and definitely improved fundamentals. Mm-hmm. Jobs picture is better. It's not great, but it's better. Household financial conditions are better. Incomes are growing some. Sentiment's a lot better. So on our own, we would be okay and fine. And let's hope it stays that way in the face of these shocks.
And China's talking about more stimulus right now, too.
Yeah, that's a plus. They have a lot more ability to stimulate their economy. They're not surprising us yet. We thought they would go down to 7% year over year, and they've started to try to turn that around. But they are getting buffeted from Europe.
Would be great here, but they're used to 10% or something like that. But they're sitting on a pile of dough. Can't they crank up their engine?
Yes, they can. And look, the policymakers in Europe will do something. They will try to do something. They probably will try to muddle through. What they ought to do is the ECB should cut rates.
European Central Bank.
Yeah, they should be sure to liquefy the system some more. Probably a euro bond would make some sense, but Germany's against that in order to insure it. And they should get that mechanism where they have almost $1 trillion pot to deal with troubles in Spain and Italy and other countries. Give up on Greece, let them go, save their money, and use it to preserve a firewall around those countries like Spain that need money to consolidate and fix their banking system.
But they've been talking and talking and behind the curve. Now George Soros is talking about disintegration, and in a matter of, I think, months he's talking, not very many months. Lots of listeners lined up here. Let's begin to go to them. New Bedford, Massachusetts, Mike is calling. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that the phrase black swan really isn't accurate. I think that all these, most of these events are very foreseeable. They might be unthinkable, but we should know when, you know, when people and countries and banks have a lot of debt, that it's entirely foreseeable that not all of it's going to get paid back.
Yeah, yeah.
So the black swan was more something like a tsunami or an earthquake that, you know, woke up one morning and found out, you know, Japan was flooded. And
Mike, we've got it. Let me put it to both of my guests. I appreciate your call, Mike. I mean, Ken, you know, there's the listeners picking up on that not our fault kind of note that comes with the black swan. People want accountability. This was all foreseeable. How can you call it sort of out of nowhere? How can anybody call it that?
Whenever you have a deep financial crisis like we did in 2008, then like day follows night, you get some countries defaulting afterwards. What we're seeing in Europe, that's a core of the problem. That always happens. The part of it that really is just, you know, way out of the box is this idea that we'll share a checking account, this idea of the euro currency, which just ties their hands in a lot of complex ways.
But that structure's been there for decades.
And I think economists have been screaming about this for 30 years, saying mm-hmm. this was nuts, saying that if they didn't have bigger political union, it was a problem. And what they said back was, well, okay, but we'll get a political union. Yeah. We'll take care of those problems later. Yeah. This is not an out-of-the-box event. This is something you could see coming for a long time.
Alan, it's not a black swan. There it was, flying all around.
By that I meant it's mm-hmm. unique in history. We haven't seen what we have now in total.
Effort toward union, this union,
no,
but not really.
No, all this and all the ramifications starting with Greece, and now mm-hmm. look how big it's become. Mm-hmm. You know, the knit of Greece mm-hmm. Is now the Achilles heel of the world in terms of what it's grown to. And so it's a Greek tragedy as well as potentially for the world. No, but I agree with Ken. I think you could see it coming. I think a lot of economists, including myself, Ken, thought that the original concept of the Eurozone without a political fabric and union was unworkable at some point, especially under stress.
Yeah.
It analytically breaks apart. And so the responses to that have been terrible. What everybody missed, though, is what always happens in these crises, the political backlash. It's not just economics, political mm-hmm. backlash. 9 changes in leaders, a new French leader, mm-hmm. Merkel, perhaps on the ropes in Germany, mm-hmm. and the interaction then of those political leaders who are not economists.
I just want to briefly underscore the stress. Mm-hmm. The Europeans will say, it's your fault. The United States did this. If you hadn't had your financial crisis, we'd have been fine. But you know what? Stuff happens. If it wasn't us, China would have had a crisis. Somebody would have. You can't fall apart every time something goes wrong in the global economy, and they fell apart at the first crisis.
Stuff happens. I don't know how well that's going to go down when the stuff happens. But here's Angela Merkel. She was talking yesterday in Berlin. This is before a meeting with European Commission President José Manuel Barroso, saying we need more Europe, not less Europe. This may be presaging some kind of big deal here. Here's Merkel.
We need more Europe in the Eurozone, not less Europe. Part of that's also the European institutions like the Commission having more possibilities for control. Otherwise, a monetary union cannot work. The fiscal pact is a first step, but it's not enough.
Merkel with more Europe, not less Europe. But the Germans don't want euro bonds, but they're talking about some big pot of cash that would cover debt, all the debt that's outstanding right now.
I think Chancellor Merkel is showing her hand. It's more of the German model with a modified austerity, which hasn't worked, toward the political union side of it, which is, I think, curative. They could get that done, curative. But the politics of this are treacherous in terms of getting it done. It's much more likely to disintegrate in the way that George Soros describes it, and I might describe it, than to get this. And what they will try to do in the meantime is to muddle through, and they will do something near term to deal with the situation as it exists. And I think the ECB will take some actions. The U.S. may try to take some actions because we have our own problems here. So it's a fluid situation. We'll have moments of happiness and relief. But fundamentally, without political union, which is very tough, the economics of it and the way it's running say it really has to break apart.
Political union, I mean, a surrender of some sovereignty here. I mean, what they're talking about, what we're reading about today, is a plan to combine a bunch of Europe's bad debt into one giant fund with like a 25-year fund, but not a sort of rolling, jointly issued debt Eurobond situation, Ken.
Yeah, well, they're going to find some way to try to write down some of this debt and transfer it to Germany. I don't think there's any doubt. But all of this at this point is political cover for their central bank to print money. That is the only game in town. This thing is way out of control. Somebody has to come in with a credit card with unlimited credit that says it stops here.
And only who has those? Germany, the U.S., China?
Actually, only the central banks have this to do it that quickly. Remember, in the United States, remember how we argued about the TARP? That was the bailout, the $800 billion bailout, which at the end of the day was not the major step. That was political cover for the Fed to put our central bank, put much more money in. And that's what's going on in Europe. No one has the firepower but the European Central Bank, but it needs political cover.
Does that mean, if the credit card gets out, does that mean we're buying into inflation down the road or not?
There's a good chance it could end in inflation, but the only way for it not to is as they lose money, they're going to have to get recapitalized by the German taxpayer, because the European Central Bank going to be, the way it prints money is it buys junk debt that eventually doesn't get paid. And when it doesn't get paid, it either has to print money to cover its losses or have the German taxpayer give it the money. One way or the other, the Germans lose because they're the big creditors.
And there we're back to politics, and Germans hate inflation. Ann Arbor, Michigan, John is calling. Thanks, John. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call. In the past, I've been a strong advocate of a Keynesian approach to macroeconomic policy, but I no longer believe that such an approach is either feasible or desirable, given the liquidity and fiscal traps we have fallen into, and the realities of peak oil, that is, the maximum production of conventional crude, which in its 2010 report, even the International Energy Agency has come to accept. With the arrival of peak oil, the idea of sustainable growth is surely becoming an oxymoron, at variance with economic stability, the maintenance of which will require the development of new stabilization policy tools. That's kind of my statement. I think that we, the Europeans, and the Chinese are all existing, operating in a fantasy world that's no longer extant, and we have to look at new approaches to these problems.
John, let us pick it up right there. You put some big ones on the table. If we can break it into a couple of parts. And, I mean, first, just what about the peak oil sustainable growth formula that John makes? Do you buy that, Alan?
No.
Can't have it.
But on the Keynesian economics, it didn't work here. the fiscal stimulus, which was Keynesian, this episode didn't really work.
Paul Krugman says central. That's because you didn't spend half enough.
I understand the argument, but it didn't work. The austerity, which is Keynesian economics mm-hmm. in reverse, mm-hmm. did work in
Yours.
Europe. And
did?
It's put, oh, sure, it made the situation much worse. The imposed austerity was fiscal constraint.
In what sense is that working?
I'm saying that aggregate demand restraint
mm-hmm.
took down Europe to much worse than expected for the policymakers and everybody else situation. And here, the stimulus didn't really work. We can explain that another time. That's
yeah.
pretty esoteric. In terms of the statement of the reader and the peak oil, mm-hmm. Look, inflation is the least of the worries now. We can't fix everything at once. I wouldn't worry about inflation at all. Ken has it right. The central banks have to flood and print more money. That's where they have to do. Do not worry about inflation in a world economy that's slipping and oil prices are coming down, may come down more, and where that will bring down inflation more. Inflation is absolutely not a worry now.
John's got big stuff on the table. I want to work through it. But Ken, your first reaction on the Keynesian side, he says, he's lost his faith, our caller.
Well, I actually want to start on the
okay.
peak oil.
Okay.
I think if you want to talk about bright spots,
mm-hmm.
The finding shale gas in the United States, this is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. This has been a huge boon. This is going to have effect for decades. If we didn't have the financial crisis going on, you know, we'd be dancing about this. And it's helping us a lot compared to everybody else. There is innovation in technological innovation, artificial intelligence. I mean, there's definitely a lot of things which can keep growth.
You might not dance that the fracking was in your backyard, but I take your point.
Well, they're paying them a lot, of course, to do it. As far as Keynesian stimulus, I mean, you know, there's just limits to it because at the end of the day, it piles up debt, and that debt is a albatross on your economy for decades. And you have to trade it off. And I think, you know, for now, it was sensible. But as far as doubling our deficit, my gosh, it's already 8% of GDP in the United States. We're supposed to double it, like, you know, some commentators have been saying. I don't think that's a way forward. It'll just cost us too much in the long run.
But look at the terms that John is looking at this in. First of all, I mean, not only he's not just giving up on Keynesian economics, he's giving up on the notion of sustainable growth. That's kind of at the very basis.
We don't agree with that. I mean,
but that's the kind of thinking that this kind of moment produces. And when you look at what's going on in Europe, you know, people. I also hear people talking about is the West sort of done here? Is Europe, if they're going into some sort of, I don't know, decades long trough as Asia's surging up? I mean, is this one of those kind of hinge moments that we're?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's been in the cards for a long time. The developed world growth rates are weaker. We have a lot of sovereign debt in a number of the developed countries. And that albatross, you know, the lenders never let you forget. You have to pay it back or they end up forgiving it or defaulting on it. That's what happens. But it compromises growth. And the key is here. What would we be doing with this lousy, underperforming economy in the United States if we didn't have the deficits and debt? We'd be cutting taxes and we'd be raising spending. We can't do it because we have more deficits and debt. We are stuck. And so is much of the Western world. Asia and China is not. China has a tremendous amount of
They've
capacity
got options.
To expand.
Mm-hmm.
And they are growing much faster than we are. And over a long period of time, I do believe it is the old have-nots have become more of the haves.
The wheels of history turning
the
right
wheels
here.
Of history, definitely on a long 5-year, 10-year, 20-year span. This is part, to me, of the process of the decline, relatively speaking, of the United States.
A thousand-year story grinding to a halt here, Ken?
I don't think it'll happen so fast. I mean, I think we're still 50, 100 years out to where we're really talking about that. China's got its own problems. Europe will probably come together over this, we hope.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the fear of a stall out in the world economy. You can feel it right now, right around the planet. And looking at the road ahead scenarios with Harvard economist Ken Rogoff, co-author of This Time is Different, and Alan Sinai, chief global economist, strategist, president of Decision Economics. Let's go to listeners. Lots of them lined up here. Des Moines, Iowa. Dan, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Just a quick question. You guys were talking about how this is going to ultimately affect the United States. And I believe the number of 14% came up in terms of our exports, and that kind of...
As percent of economy, yeah, kind of. Mm-hmm.
And being in Iowa and being, around agriculture so much, I mean, it's certainly our understanding that agriculture is a large part of that 14%. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that offers some insulatory benefits to us. We are kind of still the breadbasket of the world. And agriculture is very strong in the United States, and a lot of that has to do with export. And does that insulate us in some sort of way? I mean, we're not exporting so many cars and nuts and bolts and things.
It's a great question, Dan. Let us pick it up, and I appreciate your call. Alan Sinai, agriculture as an American anchor in a storm. Everybody has to eat, even if they don't have to buy a new car.
Today it looks okay if some of these bad scenarios occur. Commodity prices go down. And that is negative for our agriculture and the revenues that go to our agriculture companies. So, no, I'm afraid I can't tell you you're safe. I would tell you.
Even down at the food market?
Oh, absolutely.
Prices go down population goes up?
We have to buy enough to eat here in this country, and that will always
be true. And abroad is Dan's point.
Yeah, but no, I think commodity prices going down is a very big negative for agriculture. So that I would say – don't lose any sleep at night. Just be alert. And when you run your business, whatever that is, and your personal portfolio, be aware that if it gets bad enough, Ken and I are talking about what ifs here.
Mm-hmm.
The basic prospect is okay.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Mm-hmm. We're on the seamy side of the street, so I want the mm-hmm. listeners to understand
mm-hmm.
the context in which we are talking so mm-hmm. we don't totally scare them.
Right. If it goes.
But I think prudence for this gentleman who called is to be watchful because commodity prices are going down. Global downturn takes commodity prices down. We get disinflation or deflation. That's a problem for our exports.
Harry in Rockingham, Vermont. Harry, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Ex-oil trader. I agree with Ken Rogoff on the oil. We're going to be energy sufficient in 10 years. On China, it's a red herring with them. They got 1,200,000,000 people, and most of their benefits are really concentrated about 300 million. But my big question is, as of Friday, these central banks in Manhattan have $2 trillion. Wouldn't we be able to somehow push back that wave from Europe that's coming over to the United States?
You mean the commercial banks in
they got $2 trillion in cash, and it would seem to me, and a lot of guys agree, that if our American banks would start lending to the people, to people, businesses, small and large, whatever, wouldn't that somewhat insulate us from the hangover from Europe?
Do you mean they should lend to Europe or lend to you, Harry?
Well, lend to American businesses, American homes, mortgages, whatever.
You know?
I mean, they have $2 trillion in cash.
Yeah.
Why should we bail out the Europeans?
And that's just the commercial banks, never mind the Fed. Ken Rogoff, how about it? We got the resources, says Harry. Let's get some moving here, and our economy can buck up.
Well, you know, a piece of it is that a lot of people don't want to borrow and take on new debt. So our corporations are flush with money, but they're not investing in not just in equipment, but in workers because they just don't know what's coming. And by the way, it isn't just Europe and China. Let's not forget about the political situation here, the so-called fiscal cliff, this huge change, fiscal tightening coming in 2013. Nobody believes it will happen, but nobody knows how it's going to get fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates a huge uncertainty. So you're a business or a bank, you're facing, you don't know what direction things are going, and you wait. It's a very natural thing to do.
What about quantitative easing then? And even if it's not the commercial banks, can the Fed bring back the liquidity to get things rolling?
Well, it can. So certainly there's room to do that. But it's very hard to move ahead of the Europeans right now because, frankly, the euro, their currency, needs to sink. That would just be the best thing for everybody. Build up their exports, build up their tourism. And you say, oh, wait a second, that's at our expense. But you know what? They're our Achilles heel right now.
Mm-hmm.
If we do quantitative easing that makes the dollar go down a bit, yeah, it helps us a little bit. But that's not the big problem at the moment. We need to see the European Central Bank move first, and the Fed probably will come in due time.
Seth in Providence, Rhode Island. Seth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in southern Spain for a while, and I noticed my neighbors, go to work from 9 to 5 with a 3 or 4 hour siesta lunch break So I'm wondering if some of these problems go beyond economics and politics and really go to productivity and culture.
That's kind of the German line here, and they want that culture to become more Germanic. How about it, Alan?
The gentleman is right. The European culture is very different. We're seeing the results of that now and the results of a lot of welfare state support by governments in terms of what's happened. And the sun is setting on those kinds of approaches to dealing with problems. We work hard in our country, so we don't understand in Spain and in Greece what they do. We love to go there as tourists, but we don't understand it. The Asians work very, very hard as well. So I have to put my bets ultimately on the countries that work very hard where productivity is higher. The U.S. is one of those. So is Asia. And I think Europe. I couldn't put my bets on Europe.
Well, how does that work for Europe, Ken? I mean, you can see right there why Germans are saying, wait a minute, we're not hitching our whole buggy to that. What about it?
You bet. I mean, that's really at the heart of what their problem is.
Soros is saying this is really about competitiveness. I guess he's saying pull up your socks there, to Southern Tier.
But I think Seth is right. It's more than just competitiveness. There are deep development, cultural differences that eventually may get worked out. But the Euro project, I'm particularly talking about the currency, was the idea that somehow we could accelerate this development. We could change the ways of Greece and Spain and Italy really fast by merging them with Germany and France, and it has not come through very quickly.
Wow. Let's go to Rico in Greensboro, North Carolina. Rico, you're on the air. Hello, Rico. Are you there, my friend?
Did we scare him away?
Yes, sir. I believe innovation is a good thing, but it also has kept jobs from being come on into the situation.
Yeah? How so?
Well, one, since the a warehouse I used to work with, they have laid off half of the warehouse because innovation now, they use computers to take over the jobs that they used to have. Forklift, as an example, now they have computers that is operated not by man but by a machine.
Yeah.
Take away half the jobs there.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have seen that, Rico. I'm glad for your call. I'm looking at another situation like that. This is Glenn Metalcraft in Princeton, Minnesota, being quoted here in USA Today. And Joe Glenn, who runs it, says, we're not hiring and we're not replacing. And this is on the hiring front. His sales jumped 40% last year, but he's kept his unemployment flat. And he says he's just added more computer-controlled metalworking machines and robots to load the raw material in. I mean, what about on the jobs front? We saw the bad report last week. If we get growth, is it really going to be jobs?
The jobs growth is going to be anemic on the establishment side for a long, long time. Why? You run a company. Labor is the most expensive cost. You want to maximize shareholder value. And so you don't really want to hire people. And we happen to have tremendous innovation, technology, robots, all the things we see every day around. And we replace people with that. The profits are good. Business cash flow is solid. They're raising some dividends now to pay us back some of it. But it is a built-in systematic tendency to produce fewer and give us fewer jobs per unit of output.
Yeah, but robots don't go out to eat. They don't buy new wardrobes. They're not consumers.
That's a problem.
Ken, here's a listener. Yar says, your guests are whistling through the graveyard. The U.S. is sustainable on consumerism. What? Question mark. Our consumerism is funded on Chinese credit. You know, how do you find sustainability here?
Well, I don't think there's any question that we, although we're the strongest economy out there, we have a fantastic franchise, but we have been borrowing to support it, and the market hasn't called our bluff yet, but it will someday, probably a while from now. But there's no question about that. Our culture of consumerism will come to an end today. Our huge deficits will close up someday, but that's a big
source of uncertainty. What drives the economy if the culture of consumerism closes up shop?
Well, eventually we would have to have more exports and less consumption to balance things. It's just accounting. There's no doubt about that.
How do you move the wealth around if it's robots who build the exports? How do you improve the lot of the American people in that scenario?
I mean, that's a really fundamental question, Tom. I mean, certainly over really long periods, people get reeducated. They readjust. That's a very tough thing to tell someone who's been doing
learn how to build
for
robots.
20 years. Yeah. Well, indeed. I mean, you know, on paper, everybody ends up getting employed, but it can take a long, long time to make that transition.
Tina in Lexington, Massachusetts. Tina, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment, kind of a two-pronged comment.
Mm-hmm.
Austerity did not work for Europe. I don't think it would work here. And while I know that we probably couldn't push on stimulus, but the idea that the Republicans are going back on the agreement to cut spending on Pentagon it's ridiculous. It's terrible that they change the rules once they've decided on something, and then they change the rules, and then where can that money go elsewhere?
Yeah, let's talk about that if we may. Thanks, Tina, for your call. Let's talk politics in Washington. You both have said it's not just Europe that's having trouble adjusting and getting their economies well situated here. Americans have a big choice coming up this year on the White House front. How do you see that playing out? First, you, Alan.
First of all,
in terms of where the economy goes.
Yeah, the tax increases that are legislated now to come into play in the beginning of 2013.
The end of the Bush tax cuts.
Yeah. Look, for middle and lower income families, they should be extended, and Washington should do that right away. They should not wait till after the election. I'm afraid they probably will wait till after the election. They
but
can
everybody
fight about,
says we can't pay off the debt if those are extended.
No, because you can cut. We're not going to pay off the debt.
Make it manageable.
A slower glide path. We don't want to abruptly take the deficit down the way the law now says we will do, which is $7 trillion over 10 years. That's too abrupt. That's too much austerity. Something about half of that would be okay. Mm-hmm. But we do not and should not raise taxes or let taxes go up from the fiscal side at this time.
On the middle class.
Yeah,
and
let them
below.
Fight about the rich. That's mm-hmm. the big argument that mm-hmm. keeps them
occupied.
And let them fight about that beyond the election. But we really look, both sides, the Obama administration is not proposing tax increases for middle and lower income families. They're proposing hold the Bush tax cuts there, and the Republicans don't want taxes to go up on anybody. So the politics of getting hung up over the rich is holding us back from doing something that would reassure business and everybody else that everyone's taxes aren't going up in the beginning of January.
Ken, Obama, Romney, the path ahead, how does it matter?
Well, I think it, unfortunately, is not just about the president. I'm not sure that if Romney gets elected, he'll have any more mandate than Obama would if there's a, say, Tea Party-dominated Republican House that he has to deal with. In some sense, the Republican Party's been divided, and that's made it hard to cut a deal. There's just not agreement. I mean, we're not Greece, but yet it's similar. We can't reach agreement. We're not Spain. They can't reach agreement. The markets aren't forcing us to do something. Frankly, a decisive victory by either side that gave them a mandate to do something for a while would be better than hanging in the middle and lurching directionless.
Perpetual gridlock there. Lou in Monterey, Virginia. Lou, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is a longer-term historical one. Are there historical precedents that would be instructive for U.S. policy looking forward would help us make some comparisons? Or are we in an unprecedented situation?
It's a good question, Lou. I'll take it to Ken. You've got 8 centuries of financial folly right there in your book title, Ken. What about historical precedents?
Well, I think the thing I'd particularly want to underscore is that we really didn't do anything about the private debt problem. It's still out there. And the countries which addressed that faster found ways really to write down the debt. And here I'm talking about the household mortgages particularly. They recover faster. And I still think we need to find a way to do that.
You mean to help people write down debt?
Yeah, to say we have a $100,000, make it $80,000, or $70,000, and in return, you give up some of the equity if, goodness, your house price ever goes up.
Is there precedent for that? I mean, we've got a listener somewhere in the stack of emails here saying, how about a jubilee, a sort of a debt forgiveness jubilee?
Well,
have
I mean—
have people done that?
Countries? It's been done for poor countries, certainly, periodically, and perhaps done, in the Middle Ages when they weren't going to get paid anyway. Mm. But I think a little bit more targeted would make sense, because otherwise you just undermine all confidence in our system. But, a lot of these debts, whether you're talking about Europe, whether you're talking about household mortgage, they're not going to get paid. And when you take a long time to – they're not going to get paid in full. And the longer you take to recognize that, frankly, the creditors end up getting less money in the end. And we need to move to that sooner. But political gridlock has made that hard.
Alan, we've got a couple of minutes here. If you were king of the mountain, what are the couple of three things you would do right now?
I did say about what mm-hmm. they ought to do in Europe. They need to get that kitty up, that fund, so they can take care of Spain and Italy mm-hmm. and stop the recession in Europe from taking Germany down.
Mm-hmm.
Germany is actually benefiting from this, but that can only go so far. And the ECB should absolutely pour some more funds in and cut rates. In the U.S., Washington ought to get gone because the risk here are just too big. And what counts more is how the U.S. economy does, not who wins the election. And they're all wrapped up in winning the election and not doing what they should do. They should take care of the fiscal cliff issue early and then fight about other later on. And ultimately, the solution here is we're going to have to cut the rate of growth of government spending, release some funds, and I think to stimulate, get more growth, we use those funds, we keep taxes down, and I think we grow the economy better. What has failed is government-centric stimulus. It didn't work in Japan as a response to problems. Mm. It hasn't worked here. We need to try something different.
Ken, got a minute. 1, 2, 3, what would you like to see done?
Well, first and foremost, I'd like to see tax reform where we get rid of a lot of deductions. We call them tax expenditures, which really accounts for
to increase revenues, you mean? Or
to allow them to keep rates low, increase mm-hmm. revenues without hurting growth. And I'd like to see across the world much more aggressive central bank policy. This is a once in 7,500 years problem. Inflation is the last thing to worry about. Certainly 4 or 5% inflation would be a plus right now.
Wow. Hang on to your hats, everybody. We're holding our breath for a couple of months here, maybe longer. Big stakes. And we've learned a little more about just how big in this hour. Ken Rogoff, co-author of This Time is Different, Harvard economist. Thanks very much for being with us, Ken.
Thank you, Tom.
Alan Sinai, chief global economist at Decision Economics. Alan, great to have you.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Good luck to us all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.